from the Independent Producer Project and KCRW. I'm Bob Carlson, and this is Unfictional. Unfictional is a program of unusual characters, personal documentaries, and radio movies. And on this episode, The Other Man. Two stories each featuring a pair of men who meet by circumstance, but in each case, the meeting leaves an indelible mark, at least on one of the guys. First, the survivalist. A mountain man in Montana flees to take refuge in the woods, and a cop follows him in. There's a confrontation, and then the aftermath. Producer Nate Hedgie brings us this story. From KCRW, it's Unfictional.
I had went outside, and I was just watering and picking the dead flowers out of the baskets and making sure they all looked nice on the back patio. It is a rural place. And then we saw the Jeep approaching, and he was smiling when he drove by. Shortly after, there was an entourage of police cars following him. We realized at the end of the day that it was David Burgert that had drove by and waved.
This man, David Burgert.
David Burgert.
David Burgert is his name. He's 47 years old. He's a former Marine and a backwoods survivalist.
We're right behind him, lights and sirens, and he's waving at people like he's on a Sunday drive.
This is one of the men who tried to catch David Burgert.
I'm a former Missoula County deputy.
Burgert had been caught sleeping in a no camping zone. Not a major crime.
So this is just a nice guy that's traveling and doesn't know any better. We're going to be able to talk to him, laugh with him, just do the friendly local sheriff's office thing and send him on his way.
But Burgert took off in his Jeep. Now he was leading this sheriff and his partner deeper into the woods.
It was really eerie at that time because I just couldn't imagine what this guy's mindset was to not have a care in the world that, you know, he's being chased by the cops now for about 30 minutes.
This is a man who threatened to assassinate local politicians, judges, police officers, said he would go to war with the National Guard and threatened to overthrow the government.
They think he's been living out of his vehicle loaded with ammo to the teeth in the woods of Montana. Now, once he was the leader of an anti-government militia.
This guy is probably looking for a place to take us. There's a reality that this guy might be trying to find a place to ambush us now that we're going into the woods. He continued down the mountain road, and we were just getting up towards the peak of this mountain where there was a lot of clear cuts, and he started slowing way down and kind of moving from side to side in the road. And that's when we thought he was going to try to drive sideways in the road and get out and use his vehicle as a barricade. So we unlocked the guns from the gun rack. We racked them, got rounds in them, unbuckled our seat belts, got ready thinking we're going to have to bail out of the car. And then he just started pulling forward down the road again. He went maybe 50 feet and drove his Jeep four-wheel drive off the road and up into the pine trees. We couldn't see him anymore. We couldn't follow him in our Charger. We didn't know where he went. I looked up, a fairly steep incline, about maybe 60, 70 yards above us, and I could see the Jeep parked there. We stopped, and I could see that he had just gotten out and put on a shoulder holster that had a handgun in it and buckling on like a backpack. We leave from behind the car, start running up the hill, hollering, drop the gun, drop the gun, drop the gun. We get about 40 yards to his Jeep, and he runs from the front around to the passenger side of the Jeep and kind of disappears. Then I notice he pops up from behind the hood and lays his arms down across the hood with the handgun in his hands. And within seconds, I see the first recoil of the handgun. And as soon as I saw that, I just pulled the trigger on the shotgun.
He had never shot his weapon at anyone before.
And it turns out I ended up shooting 4 times. They say you get auditory occlusion during stressful moments where your ears basically shut off. You don't hear anything. And it happened to me 100%. I don't remember the sound of the shotgun going off, not even once.
His partner started hollering at him.
You know, he's down, he's down. We were going to go around the Jeep to clear it. We got around the Jeep, went to clear it, and there was nobody there. The passenger side door was open. There was paperwork and stuff on the ground, but he was gone. I knew he was armed, and now we could be hiding in these trees, and here we sit by this Jeep. And so I'm freaking out. I'm pointing the shotgun everywhere you can think. Every time I hear a noise, I think it's him. So we locked all the doors in the Jeep, slashed the tires. We went through the trees slowly, methodically. They opened up to a clearing on top of a ridge, and then all you could see was down in this thick valley. We couldn't see him, couldn't hear anything, nothing.
They didn't know it yet, but that was the last time anyone saw David Burgert.
David Burgert is on the loose in the Lolo National Forest in Montana, and he may be preparing for battle, trying to lure the cops into a trap.
Later that afternoon, the two sheriffs were told they could go home. They had been up there long enough, and others were going to pick up the manhunt.
So I think we got back down early in the afternoon off the mountain, came into town, and it was really weird because once we got into town, it hadn't hit us yet. We were both hungry. So we stop and eat at Arby's, you know, and I'm sitting there at Arby's and I'm like, this is crazy. We just got in this straight up shooting and I'm just sitting here having an Arby's sandwich. But I remember calling my mom and telling her, don't freak out, but I got shot at today.
FBI, U.S. Marshals, the U.S. Forest Service, and the Bureau of Land Management, and the National Guard. All in this hunt right now.
They did find weapons and food stashes all over that mountainside. Found a couple different vehicles that were registered to him that most of them were accounted for, but I believe there might have been one or two that never were, which led him to believe that he might have had a vehicle stashed somewhere at the bottom of that valley.
The sheriff's office and federal law enforcement agencies once again combed the area where David Burgert allegedly shot at Missoula deputy.
Everybody in that area was on edge for a long time. Late at night, if the people heard, you know, gunshots or heard something outside their house, everybody thought it was David Burgert.
Nearly 2 weeks after the chase began here at Fort Fizzle for militiaman David Burgert, authorities now believe he could be in disguise. The Missoula County Sheriff's Office has information that a couple days before the shootout with deputies, Burgert was looking at wigs, and by now, he could have a beard.
I lived in a little house just kind of off the highway, but right across the street is a mountain. Right behind me is the river and a mountain. And it was weird. I would go outside to go to work, and it would almost feel like he could be sitting on that hill scoping me.
By winter, there was still no sign of David Burgert.
My name is Kathy White, and I'm his second cousin. He was just a survivalist. He knew how to get in and out of the woods, and he knew things that most ordinary people wouldn't know.
Those close to Burgert say he was a man who struggled with depression and paranoia, but also fiercely loyal and loving to his family.
Do I miss David? Yes, I do. I miss our phone calls every week. If you were his friend, he'd give you the shirt off his back. And he'd help you any which way he could. The last phone call, he called me. He said, Kat, he said, I'm going to on a 50-mile hike. I said, the 50-mile hike? I said, man, you crazy. 50 miles, that's a long friggin' way. That was like 2 days later, and that's when I heard that he was running. Sometimes a good person can be pushed so far until, you know, you have no recourse but to run. That's all you can do.
Three months after the chase, Burgert came rushing back into the lives of the two sheriffs, but not in the way you'd expect.
I believe David Burgert should pay for what he did.
The Hunt with John Walsh, Sunday night at 9 on CNN.
John Walsh with America's Most Wanted was coming in with a film crew. They wanted the actual officers to both be part of it. They had hired an actor out of Bozeman, Montana to play David Burgert. And they set up the first part of their show with his history out of Kalispell and everything, but they wanted to actually do a reenactment of our shooting. We started early in the morning, right after daylight, used the same patrol car, and we had a film crew with us all day. We took them to the same spot. They had a Jeep that was similar. They filmed an entire little pursuit, and everything was going really smooth and going really well. until the actor popped over the Jeep, laid the gun down over the hood, and fired the first shot. And then, you could see in both of our faces, we just looked at each other. It came right back to us. It was like they put us right there, right back in it, same day. It was happening all over again. The first couple takes were really, really hard. And what was odd about it is we had, 10 people from the sheriff's office. We had a film crew. We had their production crew. We had John Walsh. And so here we are putting ourselves back in that place again, emotionally and physically. But this time we have an audience. And it was just a really unnerving feeling. It was almost like you could look at them for help, but you weren't in trouble.
David Burgert haunts the man who chased him that day.
This shooting has changed my life. It's 4 years after it. I'm not a cop anymore. And I still dream about not this shooting, but stopping somebody on a traffic stop and getting shot in the vest. Every once in a while, there's been twice here in the last year where I've seen people that resemble him. And it just stops him in my tracks. They look close enough like him that I just stand there and stare at him, wondering, oh my God, is that him?
That story was produced by Nate Hedgie and edited by Nick White. You're listening to Unfictional on KCRW. I'm Bob Carlson. And may I invite you to subscribe to the Unfictional podcast on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts, and leave us a nice review if you can. It helps other people stumble onto the show. On this episode, The Other Man. The cop in that last story never again saw the man who haunted him. But that kind of reunion is exactly what the next story is about. One man bumping into another man who had tortured him years before in an East German prison.
The guards I encountered were like machines, like robots. I remember I even asked one of my interrogators during an actual interrogation why they are like that. He replied matter-of-factly and with a pinch of pride. Well, they were raised to harbor a healthy portion of hatred, of course.
Die sind ja auch zu gesundem Hass erzogen.
That's Gilbert Furian, and what he experienced in an East German prison at the height of the Cold War is now a searing memory. He and other prisoners were interrogated, psychologically tortured, throughout their detention. But when the Berlin Wall finally fell, those former prisoners got a glimpse at something incredible. They fought for, and then won, the right to see the records of their own detention. Pages and pages of meticulously documented surveillance. And for Gilbert, it went even further than that, because he didn't just get a look at Big Brother's diary. Just by chance, while out shopping one day, he happened to come face to face with one of the men who interrogated him in prison.
He was going up the escalator. I was going down. My heart suddenly started thumping, but not out of fear. After all, East Germany had fallen. The Stasi was gone. I think my heart started racing because my body had its own memory. My heart remembered what this face represented to me.
Mein Herz hat sich erinnert, wofür dieses Gesicht steht.
For the full story of Furian's imprisonment by the Stasi, East Germany's secret police force, we turn to producer Tony Andrews. From KCRW, it's Unfictional, and reading Big Brother's Diary.
I guess one could say Gilbert's path towards dissidence was relatively predetermined. He was raised by parents who were very critical of the communist regime.
I have to say, I had a really sheltered childhood. I wasn't forced to go to state-run kindergarten. My mother tried to protect me from all the various attacks by the East German government. For example, she was supposed to sign a document pledging to forbid me from listening to Western radio stations. She refused to do so.
So with his mother's permission, Gilbert grew up secretly listening to music by the likes of the Beatles and the Rolling Stones. Even though he knew he was probably being watched, he made a decision. He chose to not let the threat of clandestine surveillance compromise his quality of life. Though Gilbert's attitude was necessary to keep him sane, it was naive. He would later find out that for 20 years, Three professional spies monitored him around the clock. Everything from a seemingly benign chat with a friend to what he was reading was being recorded. So maybe it was his lack of worry that eventually made him cocky enough to do something that would land him in serious trouble. Berlin in the latter part of the 20th century was filled with punks. Punks were critical of the East German government and embraced an alternative lifestyle. Gilbert decided to interview them and publish his findings in the West, never imagining what problems it would cause for him.
I definitely intended to be an agitation to the East German government, but I never thought the backlash would be as bad as it was. I knew they would find out. I hadn't made any attempt to hide my activities, but I thought they would just have another meeting with me, yell at me for being disruptive, and then send me back to work. I was wrong.
One fateful day at work, his duties were unexpectedly punctuated by the arrival of four ominous men.
Then I got a phone call from my, in modern language, supervisor. He told me to come to his office. There I found four men dressed in civilian clothing who informed me that I needed to come with them to help shed light on a case of theirs. When I asked them what that case might be, although I knew it had to be the punk interviews, they said, "We'll tell you all about that later." I insisted on taking my satchel with me, so I had to go past my office. There, as my colleagues later described, I gathered my things with quivering hands and a blanched face. And then I followed the men.
Yeah, first of all, welcome, of course. My name is Franziska Kelch, or Fran. I'm your guide then.
Franziska is a guide at the Stasi prison that Gilbert was sent to. She's taking us on a tour that traces Gilbert's path through the prison. First, she shows us the kind of vehicle Gilbert would have been delivered in.
They put you in the car here. They locked the door, so you were sitting in a small box. Some prisoners also describe a blindfold over their eyes. Other prisoners describe that their hands and their feet were tied. And then they usually did drive you around for a few hours. So you have time to become nervous. And in the end, you have no idea where you are. Then the car arrives here in the garage. The gate closes immediately, so you can't identify any building outside. Only then the guides take you out of your box. They drag you out of the car, take off a blindfold if you had some on. The neon lights here are there on purpose, so you're kind of blinded in the beginning. The Stasi has a concept they call shock of arrest.
Gilbert had no way of knowing how long this Kafkaesque episode in his life would last. When he arrived, the interrogators made their first attack on his dignity.
Before I was allowed to go to my cell, I had to come in here. This was the check-in cell. A guard in uniform stood behind the desk, ordered me to take off all my clothes. Then a second guard stood behind me and investigated various orifices. That's when I heard the order. Spread your legs. Bend over. Spread out your buttocks. Then the guard would very meticulously investigate if perhaps I had tried to smuggle anything dangerous into the building.
From there, the detainees were sent to 9x9-foot cells. Captives would be subjected to various methods of torture. One method involved placing troublemakers in a rubber cell with no sewage or light for 3 months.
Most people went into regression. You feel very helpless and very uncomfortable, so you wish yourself and you dream yourself to a place where you felt very safe and very comfortable. And for many people, that's childhood. So you basically become a 4 or 5 year old again.
Once the East German state took over the prison from the Soviets in 1951, their means of torture became less physical and more psychological in nature.
I was lucky to be interrogated during the psychological era. I knew that I would be facing my worst fears every day, but I never had to be afraid that the interrogators would beat me up, as might have been the case under the Russians. In those days, things like beatings, water interrogations, and sleep deprivation were all the norm. By contrast, my interrogator was polite. He even had an air of professional friendliness about him. In fact, He would ask me before every interrogation if I wanted a drink. I always said yes, black tea. With some lemon, he would ask.
Vielleicht mit Zitrone?
Then he would press a button, summoning a guard to bring me the tea. I thought it was a nice gesture. It was a pleasant distraction. I remember trying to channel my nervousness into the stirring of the spoon. I thought the tea was a gift. Later, I found out that all the while my mother had been forced to pay for the tea throughout the duration of my incarceration.
From the very beginning, Gilbert cooperated completely with the authorities, confessing in full to his crime. When prisoners refused to cooperate, however, the interrogators would begin to get creative.
Maybe the interrogator wants to play a game. You know, the prisoner is sitting over there, and the interrogator is sitting here, and he goes through your file. He's just reading something, and then the phone rings, and the interrogator picks up the phone. And the prisoner is sitting in the room, and he hears what the interrogator is talking about. And the interrogator says something like, ah, okay, so the boy is in the operation room, but the girl is in intensive care. Okay, thanks for the information. And then you hear nothing for a while, and then the interrogator asks, wait, before you hang up, what about the mother? And then the interrogator goes through the file again. What was her name? Anna. What about Anna? Was she in the car accident as well? Then you hear nothing for a while, and then the interrogator again, oh my God, that's so terrible. So if you know anything new, it doesn't matter if she survived or not, you have to tell me first. Then the interrogator hangs up, and he says to the prisoner, yeah, you hear, I just got some news, I have to take care of that first. My colleague brings you back to your cell, and I see you in a few days. And they move you back into your cell, and you have a son and a daughter, and you have a wife, and her name is Anna. So you sit in your cell thinking, was that my family? Did something happen to them? Where are they? And you can't call home, so you ask the interrogator the next time you come back.
Between interrogations, prisoners had to remain in their cells, where their activity was heavily restricted.
No push-ups, no sit-ups, no running around. Sleeping was not allowed. We're not allowed to hide. Exercise was also not allowed. Not allowed to lean against the wall. Was a rule for sitting as well.
One of the rules for the cell.
During the day, you had to sit on your chair or stand or walk around. Not allowed to lean against the wall. So you were not able to relax and fall asleep. You were only allowed to use the bed between 9 in the evening and 6 in the morning. During the day, the guards looked in every 3 minutes. During the night, the guards looked in every 15 minutes. And when they looked in, you had to be visible somewhere.
Gilbert's ordeal in prison eventually lasted 33 months overall. By the time he got out, times were changing. Communism in Europe had already begun to crumble.
He's produced a felt-tip pen. He's drawing a square. That's where the first mark will be. And one engineer has literally started hammering into the Berlin Wall, making a first incision.
On November 9th, 1989, the Berlin Wall came down. And soon afterwards, East and West Germany were reunited to become a single nation. And just like that, the East German state and the seemingly all-powerful Stasi were defeated. And then for the first time, a former communist state made secret police archives available to citizens who wanted to read their own files. One of the over 2 million people who did so was Gilbert Furian. His file alone was 15 inches thick.
After the East German state had fallen, everyone had the right to read their file. So I applied to do so. I remember being in the waiting room surrounded by other applicants, all with very serious expressions on their faces. I often burst out laughing at the ridiculous details the state had recorded.
To Gilbert's shock and amusement, the state had gone to great lengths to record every minute detail in his life. Here's Gilbert reading a section from his student days.
Gilbert is tall, skinny, and very pale. He has a very boyish way about him. His external appearance is relatively neat and clean, which unfortunately cannot be said about his room. His clothing is simple and unassuming. His bedroom contains only absolute necessities, like a bed, a wardrobe, table, and a chair. The room itself is messy and dirty. Things just lie around, and dishes never get washed.
From then on, they followed him relentlessly, recording every moment with German precision.
11
11:36, the subject, codenamed Writer, set off for Telmenplatz. He fell asleep during the trip and woke up soon after the station Spittelmarkt. At 11:53, he disembarked the subway at Hausvogteiplatz, where he waited for his next train. He then took that train to Alexanderplatz. At 11:55, he got out of the train at Spittelmarkt and walked towards his office, which he reached at 11:57.
There it was, in black and white. The regime's bureaucratic account of his life. Gilbert got to see a full list of the names of everyone who had ever spied on him. And to his relief, there were no close friends on the list. The sheer act of seeing the files gave him an immense sense of triumph.
The first time I read my files, I remember being really surprised, because I had no idea that I had been watched for so many years. But I think I took it quite well, because at the end of the day, the East German state, my big enemy, had ceased to exist. So I had the very satisfying pleasure of reading files that had belonged to a secret police force, which had been very important, but which had gone up in a puff of smoke. It was very satisfying to read the files.
The state had ceased to exist, but the people who implemented the state's policies didn't just disappear. So naturally, one day, as was bound to happen, Gilbert ran into his old interrogator in one of the most capitalist symbols of them all, a shopping mall.
He was going up the escalator, I was going down. My heart suddenly started thumping, but not out of fear. After all, East Germany had fallen, the Stasi was gone. I think my heart started racing because my body had its own memory. My heart remembered what this face represented to me. I followed him down the escalator. He was standing in a bargain bin. I tapped him on the shoulder. He turned around and said, "Gilbert!"
"Gilbert!"
He addressed me by my first name, the way you would if you had bumped into an old friend. It was weird. He responded to the situation with a mixture of insecurity and awkwardness.
Gilbert experienced great fear and hatred during the encounter. But, very rationally, he opted to shelve those emotions in the moment for the sake of getting more information. He ended up writing a book and a play based in part on information from his interrogator. So he wanted closure more than retribution.
He was willing to answer my questions. For many years, right up until his death, he answered all my questions. I suppose that was his way of making things right again. He said he felt very guilty because he had helped to destroy many lives. But you know what? That is an insight he never would have arrived at if his state had not imploded.
That story was produced by Tony Andrews, sound recording by Gregory Boyle. I'm Bob Carlson, producer of Unfictional. The editor is Nick White. The associate producer is Carla Green. And I hope you'll join me next time for Unfictional from KCRW.